Chapter 15. We're under siege. The Galactic Alliance has violated our airspace, marooned civilian workers on orbiters without food and water, and opened fire on our defense forces. The Alliance has committed more acts of war against us. We'll stand alone if we have to, but I invite other planets to ask themselves this. Which of you will be the Alliance's next target? Support us while you still can. Thrak and Sal Solo in a speech to the Corellian Assembly. Broadcast live on HNE's Corellian Affiliate Network. Senate Building. Day 3 of the Corellian Blockade. An ocean of people, perhaps 500,000, churned and surged around in the plaza in front of the Senate Building. Jason could see a very long line of hundreds of blue-uniformed CSF officers with riot shields and visors pulled down, forming a defensive barrier across the face of the building. It was a protest, not exactly a mass riot, given the population of Galactic City, but it wasn't a welcoming committee for the heroes of the blockade, either. Judging by the position of the police lines, there appeared to be two hostile factions yelling abuse at each other. Coruscanti versus the pro-Corellian lobby. Coruscant and the Galactic Alliance were indivisible. Jason could hear a chant taken up by thousands of voices. The Empire's back! The Empire's back! The Empire's back! It was hard to tell, but Jason assumed it was a taunt from the dissidents, and not Coruscanti enjoying the prospect of firm government. But his exploits had gone down very well in the Alliance's heartland. He kept an eye on HNE and the news holozines.
"Pity I couldn't stay in the front line," said Neothel. "That's the worst thing about command. Anchors you to a desk.
I'll remain hands-on for as long as I can," Jason said. "I'd like to show my face on the blockade line. Good for morale."
"You have an office in mind, then?"
"Don't worry, not yours.
And I note that you haven't gone back to wearing Jedi robes."
Jason dusted a speck of lint from his black GAG uniform.
"I don't see any point in provoking Uncle Luke or the Jedi Council. I know they don't enjoy being identified with my actions."
"Ironic, seeing as the Public Affairs Office says polls indicate the popularity of the Jedi Council has increased a little.
Jedi are supposed to be beyond populism, Admiral."
As Neothel's staff airspeeder slowed to skirt the crowd, Jason glanced out of the window and noted the new mix of species and allegiances forming the army of protesters.
"Well, we rounded up the Corellians, and now their places are being filled by others."
He identified various nationalities by clothing, hairstyles, snatches of language.
"Look, isn't that a couple of Rodians?"
"As long as you don't see any Mandalorians."
The closer to the lobby that the speeder edged, the uglier the mood of the crowd appeared to become. A group of CSF officers drove back the crowd with none-too-gentle shoves, emphasized with batons to let the speeder through. Jason and Neothel got out, and he took the precaution of throwing up a force shield around them. Jason almost didn't feel danger now, not in the sense he always had. He merely took account of circumstances and reacted accordingly. As they stepped out of the speeder, a hail of stones, old food containers, bottles, and other debris flew at them. All of it bounced back from the force barrier, some of it hitting the upturned riot shields. Jason turned and stepped forward into the crowd. He didn't enjoy displaying his force powers in such a vulgar way, but there were times when they could make a point. He held his hands a little way from his sides, closed his eyes, and pressed outward with his mind as if lifting his arms.
"Nothing violent. Mustn't cause a crash or a stampede. Innocent people will be hurt."
The crowd closest to him fell back a few paces, some of them looking around frantically to see what was pushing them back. More missiles rained from farther back in the press of bodies, accompanied by shouting and shoving.
but they simply bounced off the force shield, and Jason stood calmly staring back into the mass of people. A breathless silence spread from the line nearest to him, like a fast tide engulfing a shore. Even some of the CSF officers seemed frozen to the spot. Everyone knew about Jedi, but very few ever saw them in action, or felt them.
"Go home," said Jason. "Just break it up and go home before I have to do something about it."
They didn't run, of course, but he had made his point. The respite gave the CSF line a chance to push the rival groups apart again, and Jason followed Neothel into the Senate building and up to the Chief of State's office. Luke Skywalker was already there, Mara sitting beside him, and he didn't look pleased to see Jason.
"We are still not at war," Omis insisted, staring out the window at the crowds. "Does the Council still support the blockade?"
"As the only alternative to full-scale war or backing down on disarmament, yes." Luke wasn't looking at Omis. His gaze was on Jason. "How much impact is the blockade having?"
Neothel looked up from her datapad.
Jason wasn't sure how she regarded Luke. His uncle didn't feature in their conversations.
"We've intercepted or turned back around 70% of vessels trying to enter or leave the two exclusion rings. But in terms of volume of cargo and personnel, that's nearer 90%. We're stopping the big vessels but losing some of the small ones. All in all, it's biting already."
"Should we revise our policy on stopping traffic movements around the shipyards?"
"Nonviolent way of leaning on the civilian population," said Jason.
"When Dad doesn't come home when he's due back from the yards, it focuses families, and families lean on governments."
Luke stood up and watched from the window with Omis.
"And what about these people, Jason? You've cracked down on the Corellians. What about all the non-Corellians I see down there?"
Mara gave Jason a careful, don't take the bait look. He could feel the tension between her and Luke, and he knew it was more about Ben than about politics or personal rights.
"If any other national group or species threatens the security of Coruscant or the Alliance, then I'll deal with that, too."
"Within the law?" "Yes, within the law. I realize you don't approve of my methods, but someone has to carry out the damage limitation."
"We've had a dozen terrorist incidents in a few weeks," Luke said. "I'm sorry that lives have been lost, but we need to get that in perspective when it comes to how we treat billions."
That got Omis's attention. He turned from the window.
"I invite you to tell the Coruscant public that, Master Skywalker. The fact that they won't see it that way is why terrorism is always so effective. And the Senate doesn't see it that way either. The Security and Intelligence Council now has full emergency powers to take operational decisions on the handling of public safety."
Luke stood his ground. Jason had thought he was indecisive and afraid of banging heads together. But when he did take a stand, he was adamant. It was just a pity that he took a position on the wrong issues.
"I'm still uncomfortable with the armed forces being used against civilians."
"Define a civilian with a blaster who doesn't like the government, then," said Jason.
"The legitimate government has taken the decision."
Luke's tone was even and controlled.
"I'm just dissenting. And as the members of the Jedi Council aren't the elected representatives of the people, then an opinion is all that it is."
Neothel was watching the exchange with faint interest.
"This is an exquisite ethical argument, but right now I'm more concerned with stopping Corellia repairing an orbital weapon that was capable of taking out the Yuuzhan Vong, and that will, if brought back online, ruin the Alliance's entire day."
Omis almost twitched. The power play was luminous in its visibility.
"What would you prefer to do, Admiral? We failed to destroy it last time."
"We can reduce a planet to molten slag from orbit. Let's not rule out the possibility of needing to do that to Centerpoint, even if it would be best preserved to defend the Alliance."
"It's populated," said Luke.
"So are warships."
Omis interrupted, looking at his chrono.
"I don't think this takes us any farther forward.
I have a delegation from the Corporate Sector Authority coming to see me soon."
He jerked his thumb over his shoulder at the protest still going on below, which had turned ugly now as far as Jason could see. CSF officers had waded in with batons, and the telltale cloud of white gas from a recently fired dispersal canister drifted on the air, clearing a space as protesters scattered.
"Don't be surprised if we see the planetary allegiances going on down there reflected on the blockade line."
Jason took the unspoken instruction to leave, and Neothel followed him. As Neothel peeled off to go to her state office, Luke caught Jason's arm. Just a brief touch, nothing more. But Jason sensed him flinch, as if he'd had an electric shock.
"Have you got 5 minutes, Jason?"
Luke indicated a side room. Jason smiled.
"Ah, we all fall into corporate euphemisms fast, don't we? Sorry. It's code for come in here and let me read you the riot act, isn't it? It's code for we want to talk to you about Ben in private."
Jason inclined his head politely and suppressed his detectable feelings further, so that he presented quiet bewilderment to Luke and Mara. The doors of the side room closed behind them.
"Where is Ben?"
Luke asked.
"Captain Chevu is keeping an eye on him at the barracks."
Mara spoke for the first time. She'd been uncharacteristically silent in Omis's office. It was a sure sign something was wrong, because Mara always had a view, even if it didn't match Luke's. Especially if it didn't match Luke's.
"Jason, Luke's worried about Ben going on these raids with you."
"He's perfectly safe. Safer than when you sent him to attack Centerpoint with me."
"Actually, it's not his physical well-being that concerns me the most," said Luke. "I'm worried that instead of being taught to use his force skills for good, he's using them to bust down doors and round up civilians."
"It all depends on your definition of good, doesn't it?"
"I want Ben to go to the academy and get himself straightened out for a while."
"Normally I'd say that's your decision to make, as his father. But he's a Jedi, and he has a job to do at which he's actually very good. Identifying threats.
He's 13 years old, for goodness sake."
"And you thought that was old enough to send him on a commando raid? I hate to question your logic, Uncle, but this isn't making sense to me." "Go on, say it. Tell me that you think I'm turning to the dark side. That's what you think, isn't it? Let's have it out in the open. Accuse me."
"He isn't using violence. Why is it okay for Jaina, Zack, and me to fly combat missions that end in the deaths of other pilots? But it's not all right for Ben to find terrorists and help arrest them." Luke pinched the bridge of his nose. Mara's face was ashen. She looked drawn and strained. Jason decided to make his move. He could carry on without Ben as his apprentice, but sooner or later he would need one, and Ben was progressing by leaps and bounds. He liked the boy. He wanted to see him make the most of his potential.
"I don't want to put you on the spot, Mara, but do you agree with this?"
"I think we need to talk this through with Ben," she said carefully. "He's settled down well, and I think we need to discuss this when we're not so tired and irritable."
"Actually, no," said Luke. "I think there's something that needs to be said right now. Jason, you need to know that Lumia is on Coruscant. You know who Lumia is, don't you?" It took all of Jason's control to maintain his facade of ignorance and use the past tense, relegating her to history.
"Yes, she was a dark Jedi."
"She's back. She's here. I had terrible force dreams about a hooded figure threatening us all, and then I felt her somewhere near."
"Look patient, as if you're humoring him.
What's this got to do with Ben?"
"I don't know yet, but I feel it has everything to do with Ben. Don't put it past Lumia to engineer events to serve her purposes."
"Okay."
Jason feigned a half-smile, as if embarrassed.
"I'll be on my guard."
Luke appeared slightly deflated, as if he had heard his own words repeated back to him and had second thoughts about them.
"When Ben's finished whatever he's doing today, ask him to come and see me. He's not answering his comlink." There was no point having a confrontation. Ben wouldn't listen to Luke, and Jason could sense that Mara wouldn't either.
"Whatever Ben wants, I'll go along with it," he said.
Jason left and walked out to the turbolift lobby. He was torn between returning to the blockade and concentrating on his security role, but the latter was clearly more urgent. Outside, the protest had been broken up, and CSF assault ships were loading handcuffed men and women who had been arrested. The situation was going to get worse before it got better. It was time to get back to the GAG headquarters and have Shevu brief him on progress with the detainees, and especially the bounty hunter they had picked up. There was one other urgent task, though. He opened his comm link and keyed in the code on his secure link.
"Lomia," he said, "I need to talk to you."
Galactic Alliance Guard HQ, Quadrant A-89, Galactic City. More rioting had broken out in one of the commercial zones, and a couple of the GAG intelligence officers were poring over images being relayed back to them via helmet cams worn by CSF riot squads. Ben watched them for a while, trying to learn how they recognized faces and tracked the movements of what they called persons of interest around the city. When a Jedi relied on his Force senses, he never learned how to do the thinking that regular people had to do to solve problems. Jason always reminded him about that, telling him not to let his brain rust just because he had Force powers.
"Are we doing riot control now?" asked Ben.
One officer turned to him, but his eyes were still on the screen.
"That's CSF's problem. What we're looking for are faces we might know from the last job."
The intel officers were ex-CSF anti-terrorist unit. He pointed to a figure masked by the press of bodies.
"I think we've got an old buddy here who we could never quite nail on explosives charges."
They seemed pleased. Ben looked forward to accompanying them when they turned his place over, as they put it. It was interesting to learn how many terrorists had pretty basic criminal backgrounds. Ben's impression of them as fanatical people with a political cause wasn't the whole picture. It seemed that a whole range of people ended up getting involved, and for all kinds of reasons. He was learning more every hour.
"Ben?"
Shevu leaned around the open doors.
"Colonel Solo's back. Report to him in the cell block."
"Yes, sir."
Ben found himself marching down to the cell block, which happened to be the fastest and most dignified way to move without breaking into a run. He found Jason with Captain Gearden, having one of those hissed close-quarters conversations that showed they were angry with each other. The words "results" and "unacceptable" drifted toward him. Jason stopped and motioned Ben forward with a crooked finger. Gearden was clearly dismissed for the time being.
"I saw the news," said Ben. "Nice shooting." "Shooting's never nice."
Then Jason switched from annoyed to benign in an instant.
"But sometimes necessary. Look, your parents want to see you. Will you do the diplomatic thing and visit them?"
"Dad's mad at me, isn't he?"
"What makes you say that?"
"He always is. I never do things right for him."
"He's worried about you, and he needs some reassurance that I'm not teaching you bad ways."
Jason put his hand on Ben's shoulder.
"He'd rather I wasn't teaching you at all, but your mother is okay with it. In the end, I can't make him or you do anything, but for what it's worth, try not to have a fight with him."
Ben heard the meaning clearly enough. He'd be sent to the academy. He couldn't face that now. He might have a lot to learn, but he felt he'd passed the point where he could go back to lightsaber drill and meditation. He'd done real work, made a real difference, and he knew he would have no patience with theory again. Perhaps Jason could teach him more diplomacy. It seemed to be almost as handy as force listening and disguising your presence, two other things that Ben badly wanted to learn.
"Okay," he said, filled with dread. "I'll visit tonight. Now let's see what Aelin Habur has to say for herself."
The bounty hunter had been in custody for nearly a week,
and this was the first time Ben had seen her since Shavu had questioned her. She hadn't been a glamorous woman to start with, but she looked terrible now. Girdon didn't appear to have taken good care of her in Shavu's absence. There were bruises on her face. She was leaning forward, arms braced on the table, breathing with some effort.
"I really need to know who you were sent to kill," said Jason, reasonable and earnest.
He sat down at the other side of the table and indicated to Ben to take a seat near the doors.
"Was it Chief Omis?"
"I'm just a debt collector."
Harbour wasn't quite as defiant as she had been a few days earlier, but she wasn't cracking either.
"Don't let the blasters fool you."
"You were carrying enough hardware to take out a platoon. You were with a known Corellian agent, so I know which government is paying you."
"Like I said, debt collection. It's a competitive business."
"If you've come to Coruscant, you're looking for a high-value alliance target."
"You've got all you're getting out of me. Can I call a lawyer now?"
Suddenly, Habur's head slammed down on the table without warning. Ben flinched at the loud crack. Jason hadn't lifted a finger. Habur pulled herself upright again, blood trickling down her chin. She looked more surprised than hurt, although she appeared to have broken a tooth.
"Nice trick, Jedi boy."
"I've got plenty of those."
"Oh, Ben,
let's try again. Was Omis your target, and who else is working with you?" Ben still didn't believe what he'd seen. He believed it the next moment, when Jason used the force to crack her head on the table again.
"Jason," said Ben.
This wasn't right, and it wasn't Jason.
"Jason, should you—"
"Later." Jason glanced back at Ben, startled, as if he'd suddenly remembered he was in the room.
"Go and wait outside."
Ben realized he should have waited a long way from the interrogation room, where he couldn't hear anything. But he felt he had to stay close, as if distancing himself too much would have somehow allowed Jason to do worse things than he was already doing.
"So he hurts people. I was pleased that he shot down an enemy fighter. But that guy's dead. So why do I feel bad when I see him hurt someone?"
Ben took out his lightsaber and stared at the hilt, trying not to listen to the interrogation.
"This is a weapon."
He'd been trained to use it to defend himself. But he also knew that it was a blade packed with enough pure energy to slice off someone's head or cut clean through armor. He'd never killed anyone. What was a lightsaber for, then, if you couldn't face the fact that it killed people? He tried to think of Jason as using a weapon, his force powers, to defend the Galactic Alliance against people like Aelin Habur. But all he could feel was that Jason, a man he respected more than his own father, was hurting a woman who couldn't defend herself. He heard things he knew no kid should have heard, but still he couldn't walk away. He sat there for an hour, then two, staring at his hands, hearing the raised voices. Then the thuds and occasional cries of pain, and then only Jason's voice repeating the same question over and over again. Who sent you, and who were you sent to kill? Ben couldn't bear it.
"Jason, you have to stop."
Girdon and Shavu appeared at the double doors at the end of the corridor, and took one look at Ben before walking briskly to the interrogation room.
"Jason's in there,"
Ben said weakly.
"Oh, boy," Shavu nudged Girdon. "Come on, we can't let this go on.
He's the commander."
"Done, you moron, he's going to kill her. That's not how we do things."
"It was how we did things."
"Really? Not on my criffing watch."
Shavu appeared to have lost his cool. Ben watched, not wanting to stop them because he knew deep down that he should have stopped Jason somehow. Shavu overrode the lock, and Ben tried hard not to look inside the cell.
"Medic! Get a medic, someone!"
Jason snapped at Shavu to get out, but Girdon bundled in behind him, and the two officers laid Habur flat on the floor and tried to revive her mouth to mouth. Ben watched as they took turns pumping her chest, hand on fist, checking her breathing and pressing fingers on her throat to try to find a pulse. Jason stood back.
"Where's the griffing medic?"
Chavu demanded. Gearden felt her neck, then her wrist. No pulse.
"Ben, call the medic!"
Gearden shook his head.
"Too late. She's gone."
Ben stared in horror. Habur looked terrible. He'd never seen a dead person before, not like that. Not with his own cousin standing over her, as if it was just a little inconvenient for her to die before she'd answered his questions.
"What were you thinking, sir? We can't handle prisoners like this. You've got to report it. If you don't—"
"I've entered people's minds before, and they've always been fine afterward," said Jason.
He seemed surprised that his force technique had caused so much damage to Habur. But not sorry. Ben noted that. Ben was forgotten in the brief panic, invisible once again to adults having a fight.
"We have to know who she was working with."
Chavu stood his ground. He didn't seem in awe of Jason at all.
"You should have left this to me, sir."
"Time is critical in assassination attempts. They could be out there now."
"I know that, and I also know that you don't let prisoners die during questioning. I have to report this."
"You report it then, Captain, but right now I have to find out who she was after. And my only lead is some woman called Myrta Geff."
"There's the Corellian agent, sir," Gearden said, straightening up. "He doesn't know who Habur was after. Only that Corellian intelligence told him to give her a safe house and provide weapons."
"Some agent, if he yielded that much."
"I'm very persuasive, sir," said Gearden. Chavu rounded on him.
"We don't want another dead prisoner."
Jason looked through Chavu as if he weren't there.
"Get working on him, Gearden, just in case."
"I have to do something."
Ben couldn't bear to think of someone else dying like that woman had. He had an idea. Work through the information again, just like the ex-CSF man had told him. It was stupid, because Jason was smart enough to have spotted anything useful. And the World Brain's network of ferals, enslaved spies, knew plenty. If his force powers couldn't shake the information out of Habur, then Ben stood little chance of doing any better. But he decided to use the tricks that ordinary people had to when sorting through information.
"Can I see the data pad, please?"
Ben fought to stay calm. He had moved from disbelief to shock. He didn't know why Jason had done what he did, but he had to have a reason. It had to be that Ben just didn't understand it yet. He had to stay calm, but he wanted to run back home to his mother and, yes, his father.
"You can't keep doing that. It's not a game. You've grown up now. You can't do the things you do and then run home when it gets scary."
Jason handed him the data pad, suddenly all reason and concern.
"You sure you're all right, Ben?"
I just never saw a dead body like that before."
"It's okay. You want to go home? I mean home to your mom. It's okay if you want to."
"I'm okay."
Ben took the data pad and retreated to the nearest empty room. It was the cleaning droid station. He settled down on an upturned bucket and tried to look through the data in a sensible and rational way, but it was hard when you'd seen your hero do something terrible.
There.
He'd dared think it. Jason wasn't perfect. He flicked through the images in the data pad, hundreds of them, and they were all pictures of vessels just as Chavu had said. He had to scroll through them a number of times before the idea that was nagging away at the back of his mind suddenly became clear, and he spotted what was in a lot of the pictures. Not everyone, but most of them. Sometimes it was just a detail, and sometimes it was almost half the ship. But it was the same class of ship. It was a YT-1300. An old Corellian transport model that was still a common sight around the core worlds. They ran forever. Uncle Han's Falcon seemed ready to run for eternity. Ben had a flash of insight. Ben trotted down the corridor and approached Jason cautiously, hoping that he was right, and hoping that the information might save the Corellian agent from Gearden.
"She was after Uncle Han, Jason."
Ben handed back the datapad.
"That's the ship they were doing surveillance on. It's in more than half of the images. They thought he was still here. She was looking for the Falcon."
Jason shut his eyes for a moment and swallowed.
"I assumed she was in the right place. I assumed, Ben. That's a lesson for all of us. Never assume anything."
He concentrated, eyes closed, holding the datapad in his hands as if he was visioning something in the Force.
"She didn't feel focused on Dad, either.
I thought you could do anything in the Force, Jason. Why did you miss that? What blinded you to it?"
Jason opened his eyes again, looking as surprised by the oversight as Ben was.
"You're right, Ben. I feel it. Well done. So this Myrta Gav might be connected. The woman who's been trying to contact her."
He fumbled for his comlink, uncharacteristically shaken.
"I can tell Dad we've got one of the assassins Thraken sent after him. Now all he has to do is watch out for this Myrta Gav."
Jason hugged Ben with genuine relief. Ben could feel it wash over him. Shavu came out of the cell and gave Jason a completely blank look that Ben could tell didn't fit at all with what he was feeling. But Jason was too tied up with calling Uncle Han to take any notice. Ben knew what Shavu felt, and he felt a little of it, too.
"Sometimes you have to do things you don't like, and kill people because you absolutely have to."
Jason was right, but it was still horrible, and he didn't think he would ever find it easy. He left Jason to his call and decided it was time he faced his father. Corellian Assembly Building, Coronet, Office of the Corellian President. It was an awfully big office, and offices that big usually meant small-minded men occupied them. Fett remained dismayed by the ease with which the likes of Thraken Sal Solo bounced back from disgrace and even treason charges to hold high office again and again. The galaxy was a moral cesspit. It got what it deserved.
"You beat the blockade, then,"
said Sal Solo, leaning back in his splendid Apasha chair and holding court in front of the opposition party representatives. He smiled charmingly at Myrta, who didn't smile back. She didn't charm easy, that girl.
"How would you like to work for Corellia?"
"Specify your requirements regarding Centerpoint."
"The Alliance sabotaged it, but I'm embarking on repairs, and it should be fully operational in a few months."
Sal Solo used the pronoun I a great deal. Fett listened in vain for the word we.
"Once it's online, the Alliance won't be able to make us disarm. Ever."
"Then why do you need Mandalorian assistance?"
"Repair crews haven't been able to land on the station."
"Try recruiting on Nar Shaddaa. You need smugglers to run blockades, not soldiers."
"But when we do land crews, we'll need someone to defend the station. It's the Alliance's prime target."
Fett didn't care for Sal Solo. He didn't care much for anybody. But this man was what Mandalorians called a Hutun, a coward, the lowest form of life. Myrta had taught Fett a few choice Mandoa words against his will, but it seemed to be a fine language to curse in.
"How much?"
Sal Solo's eyes flickered as if he had to look to his colleagues for some mandate, but was deeply unhappy about being seen to do so.
1 million credits.
Per man?
Yes.
Per month?
That's a ludicrous figure.
It's dangerous work.
I was thinking of a flat fee. It's only going to take a few months.
We don't do open-ended contracts. Months turn into years on construction projects.
Fett really didn't want the work at all, and he knew the commandos didn't.
And no start date yet. Call me again when you put a crew on the station and we'll talk. But it's 1 million per man per month. If we do it,
We'll be bearing the brunt of Alliance attacks, and they'll probably cream your fleet first, which means we'll be defending your interests on our own.
How many men?
That thing's bigger than the Death Star. 100 at least. Fat watched Sal Solo's face fall ever so slightly. Two of the other three politicians looked grim. The third, Gedgen, seemed perfectly happy. Maybe he knew something about Corellia's budget that they didn't.
"I hope you didn't mind my dragging you all this way for such a brief meeting," said Sal Solo, still directing the occasional insincere smile at Myrta. "I'll be in touch."
"Always worth visiting Corellia," said Fett. "Yes, always worth getting inside a government building and recording the layout and weak points. Always worth finding out what your opposition buddies want. Always worth tracking down Han Solo and waiting for my daughter to show up." "I might stay a few days." The politicians laughed politely. "But not for too long. I need to track down Kosai's research. And that clone with the gloves." "Got time to show me around?" Fett asked. He figured he might as well record what he could. "Nice place you got here."
"Shall I do the honors, Mr. President?" Gedgen offered.
That didn't surprise Fett one bit. He beckoned to Myrta, who walked behind them with sullen disinterest, as Gedgen showed Fett the fine staterooms, everything paneled in gilded apasha, and the offices. All the while, Fett's helmet and gauntlet sensors built up a handy plan of the whole Corellian government complex, even the parts that Gedgen didn't show him. That penetrating terahertz radar had been a very good investment. The grounds were beautiful, too. Fett assessed the height of the walls and the nature of the security patrols while admiring a row of trees with pale blue blossoms, whose crowns were trimmed into cubes.
"I realize you're a busy man, Fett," said Gedgen, "but may I make a proposal?"
Fett kept an eye on Myrta, who also seemed to be checking out the layout of the complex, judging by her eye movements. Her Mandalorian father should have taught her the value of a helmet. "Wondered when you'd get around to it."
"Our president doesn't enjoy our full confidence. Would you remove him for us?"
"I thought you'd never ask. How permanent?"
"Totally."
"Who's paying?"
"All the opposition parties. Together we can outvote the Centerpoint Party, and without Sal Solo, they can be quite sensible."
Fett considered the contract. Timing was the issue. He wanted to pursue Kosai's data as soon as he could. "And after you see your daughter? Last time you saw her, she was too young to talk." "When?" Gedgen handed him a tiny data chip.
"When can you complete the task?"
"When I've checked you out." Fett tapped the datapad link on his forearm. Yes, the chip was valid. 1 million.
"You people deal in round numbers."
"I could make it 3 million. Yes or no?"
"Yes."
Gedgen tapped his own datapad.
"There. 500,000 up front. Balance on completion. Can we offer you a room, a speeder, back to your ship?"
"It's a nice day," said Fett. "I'll walk." Myrta matched his pace along the broad boulevard leading from the government building. She had been commendably silent. She was agitated, though. She sneaked a glance at her comlink. Aelin still hasn't responded to her. "Say it," said Fett.
"What?"
"That I should stay out of Corellian politics."
"For 1 million? If you don't do it, I will. Sal Solo gives me the creeps."
She slipped the comlink back into her pocket.
"When are you going to do it?"
"More pressing business first."
"What's more pressing than 1 million credits?
"Okay, girl, it's time." They were on Corellia, and so was Han Solo. Solo was the bait for Aelin. and one thing Fett could always do was find Han Solo. He could almost think like the man now. And he was getting tired of a kid thinking she could fool him. "I'm here to find Han Solo." He could see her expression, even though he wasn't looking directly at her. The helmet display could take an image from a wide angle. She blinked rapidly, but the rest of her face was utterly composed.
"Because Aelin's looking for him, and when I find him, I find her."
Fett didn't break his stride. His joints ached, and he wanted to sit down and rest. But he kept walking.
"So I don't get paid," she said.
"I'll pay you because I said I would. But don't play me for a fool."
She shrugged unconvincingly.
"So shoot me."
"You've still got your uses."
"How'd you know Solo was here?"
"I know Solo, and my sources are better than anyone's. He's here."
"Ah," said Myrta. "Ah."
She'd get paid. Fett couldn't understand what was worrying her. He always kept his word.